Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Jean-Paul Sartre, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 6.
Let's think a minute about this scene from Sartre's play we just heard. No Exit tells us we can't escape our involvement with others. We can't escape being vulnerable to them. That's the hell of it, you could say. At the same time, the play suggests that we might cope better with our involvement with others than Sartre's characters do. Why? Because Inez, Estelle, and Garcin are all in bad faith. Their life plans, what Sartre calls their fundamental projects, are self-deceptive. They all think it's possible to find an identity for themselves through someone else, and any such project is impossible to achieve. Inez wants to become needed by Estelle, to be Estelle's mirror so she can control her. But Estelle is free, and if she doesn't play along, Inez loses. Besides, Garcin's in the way. Estelle, on the other hand, wants to be beautiful, but the only way she can really be beautiful is if she can count on someone, Inez or Garcin, to always see her beauty and love her. Yet the others are free, too, so she can't count on that. Garcin, it turns out, needs Estelle to believe in him so he can overcome his fear that he's a coward. But he finds that his plan won't work, either. What's wrong here? Two things. First, each of these characters has chosen to become dependent on one of the others. But to make your fundamental goal, your project, depend so completely on someone else is bound to fail. This would be as true for loving and helping projects as it is for the obviously exploitative ones Inez and Estelle and Garcin pursue. But the more important flaw in this story is elsewhere. It's in the people themselves. They seem to think they can simply be whatever someone else thinks of them. They think they can just turn their freedom over to another. This is pure self-deception. Each of them thinks it's possible to achieve a permanent state of some sort, to be a self that's totally needed, beautiful, or courageous. But that's impossible. As Sartre has said so many times, you can't just be something. In each new moment, each of us must choose again the kind of person he or she will be. In principle, we can't give this responsibility away. What, then, is the sum of it all? To put it in Sartre's own distinctive language, our being for others shows that we're not our own beings. We are what we are for others, but that's like saying that we are what we are not. We can never be sure who we are, for who we are depends on others in ways we can't control. Others tend to define us by the attitudes they take towards us. We have to constantly struggle with this because we deeply need and want to be our own being, to be fully ourselves and in full control. We'd like to be simply what we are, but we can't be. We might hope simply to let others be what they are, but we can't do that either. For as Sartre points out, we inevitably act on them.
From the moment that I exist, I establish a factual limit to the other's freedom. Charity, laissez-faire, tolerance, even an attitude of abstention, are each one a project of myself which engages me, and which engages the other in his acquiescence. To realize tolerance with respect to the other is to cause the other to be thrown forcefully into a tolerant world.
So our relations with others will always impinge in some way on their freedom and our freedom. All human relations are bound to be conflicted and unstable. We can't be fully ourselves in any relation to others. Of course, Sartre says, we couldn't be fully ourselves in any case, regardless of others. Because we exist in time, we can never be fully ourselves. We are always yet to be. But there isn't any permanent self that we can simply be. Here, too, we are something, a future, that we are not. In respect of our relations to others and to time, we would devoutly like to be full and complete, to realize ourselves, we often say. Sartre expresses this deepest desire of human existence in a memorable phrase.
The best way to conceive of the fundamental project of human reality is to say that man is the being whose project is to be God.
Sartre believes we're defined by the desire to be God. We'd like to be the source of our own being, but this is a contradiction. To be a human being is not to be able to have within oneself the source of one's own being. Our human condition is precisely to aspire to a perfection and completeness of being we can never achieve. But we can act. We can act with full awareness of our freedom. We can face the fact, as none of the characters in No Exit is prepared to do, that the reality of our lives is in our actions. Maybe we can't be fully what we want to be, but we can seek authentically to express our freedom in what we do. We can't determine whether our actions will succeed or even how they'll be taken, but we can, we must, put our personal stamp on them and take responsibility for them. The first and central notion in Sartre's concept of human action is what he calls our freedom in situation. He says we're radically free to choose and to act, but we always do so in relation to the conditions in each situation. Some of these conditions are in us, our bodily capacities, for example. Others are in the circumstances we face, in past events, in the social institutions and practices around us, and so on. We're free, but we have to respond to the givens of the situation in which we find ourselves. But this is puzzling. How can we be radically free and at the same time condemned to respond to certain givens? Sartre thinks he can answer that. In his approach to human freedom, he thinks he's able to solve, or rather dissolve, the age-old problem of determinism and free will. We have to affirm something from the determinists, who say all actions have motives and causes. And we have to affirm something from the proponents of free will, who say that none of these motives and causes can compel us to act. Sartre believes that we must learn to think of human freedom in a truly new way. We have to realize that freedom isn't itself a cause. Rather, in Sartre's now familiar language, freedom is a nothingness in our being. It's a nothingness which puts a distance between us and our past, and between us and any causes or conditions in our situation. And freedom is that through which those causes and conditions have their very meaning and force. Sartre illustrates his thesis by an example. Imagine, he says, a worker who finds himself in the midst of the political ferment that was growing in France in 1830. His already miserable salary is about to be further reduced. This worker is clearly in a situation not of his own making, and he must respond to it. He thinks of joining a rebellion, but he doesn't. Why not? He's not held back by fear or force of habit or some such. His suffering isn't overwhelmed by some other motive or cause. The worker's problem is that he can't conceive of a better life for himself.
Although he feels badly, he does not represent his sufferings to himself as unbearable. He adapts himself to them, not through resignation, but because he lacks the education and reflection necessary for him to conceive of a social state in which these sufferings would not exist.
The worker's suffering is not yet a motive or cause at all. In his freedom and within these circumstances, he has simply defined his present condition as natural or inevitable. He's not even conscious of it as suffering. When, on the other hand, his suffering does motivate him to do something, it won't be because something called his suffering has finally pushed him from behind. Rather, both his freedom and other people will have helped him to envision a future state which would be very different from the one he's in now. In the light of this projected future, he will then see his present condition as suffering, and he will have chosen to be motivated by it.
His suffering cannot be in itself a motive for his projected acts. Quite the contrary. It is only after he has formed the project of changing the situation that it will appear intolerable to him and that it will provide a motive for his action.
Sartre is saying that situations look bad only in terms of our chosen projects. A motive arises to change a situation only when we actually envision a better possibility. So it's a sham to set up a philosophical determinism in which we are, as it were, pushed or pulled around by motives and conditions.
We must thereby conclude that it is by fleeing a situation toward our possibility of changing it that we organize this situation into complexes of causes and motives. The result is that it is, in fact, impossible to find an act without a motive. But this does not mean that we must conclude that the motive causes the act. The motive is an integral part of the act. The motive, the act, and the end are all constituted in a single upsurge. It is the act which decides its ends and its motives. And the act is the expression of freedom.
Of course, at each moment, you are in a situation of some sort. You do have many feelings about it, many desires and fears, for example. But at each moment of choice, these feelings are parts of your past, separated from you by what Sartre calls a breadth of nothingness. These feelings can't, by themselves, force you to do anything. When you choose, it's you that gives these feelings whatever meaning they have.
The meaning held for me by this desire, or this fear, or these objective considerations of the world, when presently I project myself toward my future, this all must be decided by me alone. Past motives, past causes, present motives and causes, future ends, all are organized in an indissoluble unity by the very upsurge of a freedom which is beyond causes, motives, and ends.
This is a radical notion of freedom. Sartre believes that the meaning of the past and future is all bound up with the present moment. The meaning of the situations you confront is determined by the choices you make. You can't just consult these so-called objective factors or add up your motives and desires as if this were a merely contemplative matter. Your attempt to evaluate the alternatives objectively actually covers up the fact that you've already chosen which motives and causes will count for you.
The result is that a voluntary deliberation is always a deception. How can I evaluate causes and motives on which I myself confer their value before all deliberation and by the very choice which I make? And if I'm brought to the point of deliberating, this is simply because it is a part of my original project to realize motives by means of deliberation rather than by some other form of discovery, by passion, for example, or simply by action.
Sartre thinks there's no escape from it. Deliberation simply reveals what you've already chosen. And even to deliberate is a value you choose. You choose yourself at each moment. In so doing, you choose your very assessment of the situation. You choose everything at once, the problems and possibilities you see, the motives you find, the ends you embrace. So you have to take responsibility for it all. But wait a minute. Is such a radical view of freedom really plausible? Since each act is taken to be a fresh start, each project an unanalyzable upsurge of freedom, does this mean that Sartre supposes human life to be a series of capricious jerks? Am I supposed to be free to choose anything whatsoever at any moment whatsoever? Not at all. Sartre thinks our projects are organized. Our actions have a unity because each of us at a deep level is committed to a certain distinctive cluster of values which defines us individually. These values, though changeable in principle, inform each momentary choice until we go through some drastic change. Sartre calls this the original or fundamental project. Each of us takes up a fundamental stance in the world. Whenever I get beyond superficialities and try to understand you, I'm trying to understand your fundamental project. Again, Sartre offers us a nice example.
I start out on a hike with friends. At the end of several hours of walking, my fatigue increases and finally becomes very painful. At first, I resist, and then, suddenly, I let myself go. I give up, I throw my knapsack down on the side of the road, and let myself fall down beside it. Someone will reproach me for my act, and will mean, thereby, that I was free. That is, not only was my act not determined by any thing or person, but also I could have succeeded in resisting my fatigue longer. I could have done as my companions did. and reached the resting place before relaxing. I shall defend myself by saying that I was too tired. Who is right?
Sartre immediately insists, of course, that he could have done otherwise. He wasn't forced or determined by his fatigue to throw down his knapsack and stop. He could have gone on, but at what price? He could have gone on, he says, but only at the price of changing his entire way of relating to things, his entire fundamental project.
Let us note, first, that the fatigue by itself could not provoke my decision. For fatigue is only the way in which I exist my body.
Sartre is saying his fatigue is just a bodily state he's living through. It hasn't decided, it couldn't decide what Sartre would do, except maybe in some extreme case of total bodily collapse. Still, his fatigue is one of the givens of the situation Sartre faces. But there's more, too. Sartre points out that he's in no worse health than the rest of the group. For all practical purposes, they're as tired as he is. How does it happen, he asks, that they experience their fatigue the way they do? Why do they suffer their fatigue so differently from the way he does?
If I ask one of my companions, he will explain to me that he is fatigued, of course, but that he loves his fatigue. He gives himself up to it as to a bath. It appears to him, in some way, as the privileged instrument for discovering the world which surrounds him, for adapting himself to the rocky roughness of the paths, for discovering the mountainous quality of the slopes. In the same way, it is this light sunburn on the back of his neck and this slight ringing in his ears which will enable him to realize a direct contact with the sun. Finally, the feeling of effort is for him that of fatigue overcome. It is given as a way of appropriating the mountain, of suffering it to the end and being victor over it. Thus, my companion's fatigue is lived in a vast project of a trusting abandon to nature, of a passion consented to in order that it may exist at full strength, and, at the same time, the project of sweet mastery and appropriation. It is only in and through this project that the fatigue will be able to be understood and that it will have meaning for him.
Sartre has asked the question, why do my companions suffer their fatigue so differently from me? For one of them, as we've seen, the answer seems to be that he's chosen a fundamentally different way of relating to his body. His choice is more sensuous and abandoned than Sartre's choice. The companion relates to existence, to the in itself, in a much more accepting and appropriating way than Sartre's chosen to do. Sartre continues,
therefore, if I apply this same method to interpret the way in which I suffer my fatigue, I shall first apprehend in myself a distrust of my body. For example, a way of wishing not to have anything to do with it, wanting not to take it into account, which is simply one of numerous possible modes in which I can exist my body. I shall easily discover an analogous distrust with respect to the in itself in general. Hence, my fatigue, instead of being suffered flexibly, will be grasped sternly as an importunate phenomenon which I want to get rid of. And this is simply because it incarnates my body and my brute contingency in the midst of the world at a time when my fundamental project is to preserve my body and my presence in the world by means of the looks of others.
If we think about this parable, the friendly hike, maybe we can understand what Sartre's getting at when he speaks of a situated freedom. A freedom that is radical, that constitutes our way of being in the world, keeps making us choose the meaning of our lives. But its freedom is up against real conditions in the world, conditions it doesn't make, to which it must respond. We confront the in itself, the environing world, the mountainous path and the hot sun. We confront our bodily condition, our fatigue. We can't just wish them away. Human freedom may be radical, but it's not all-powerful. At the same time, we determine what these conditions mean for us by how we react to them. We're not forced to throw down our knapsacks. We choose to do so. When we choose, each of us reveals something of our fundamental choice of values, our distinctive individual character. This individual character is what colors all we do in ways we may not realize. There's no clear limit to the ramifications of our fundamental choice. And there's also no finality to our choice. Our environment, the things we surround ourselves with, our jobs and friends, tend to reflect back to us the fundamental choice of values we have made. This is an engagement we perpetually renew.
The result is that we are perpetually threatened by the instant. That is, we are such, by the very choice of our freedom, that we can always cause the instant to appear as the rupture of the unity of our project.
So we can go through those remarkable moments when our whole system of values is changed, when we experience a conversion from one fundamental project to a very different one. Religious conversions are sometimes like this. So are dramatic changes in personal lifestyle and in political commitments. Such moments are rare, but the point is, they're always possible. At such times, we can experience the utter contingency of our values, the anxiety of our being.
This is the end of Part 6. Please download Part 7 to continue.